Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. The Picnic, A Dream of Freedom and the Collapse of the Iron Curtain by Matthew Longo. Gorbachev will pay for his sins. I can't stand the sight of his pig's mug. On a winter day early in 2001, Grigory Romanov, once the party boss of Leningrad and an odds-on favorite to take over the Kremlin, stood on a Moscow sidewalk, ranting to me, a Moscow correspondent for Time magazine, about Mikhail Gorbachev. In the spring of 1985, Romanov had famously lost his shot at the government's top post to the prematurely balding apparatchik from Russia's south. It was Gorbachev, a peasant who had no right coming to the big city, Romanov all but shouted at me, who started this disaster. The people in the borderlands between East and West, above all, the Hungarians, Poles, Czechs, Slavics, and East Germans, may disagree. The millions trapped for decades in the Soviet bloc can claim a bit of the credit for its disintegration. And so it's only fitting that in The Picnic, Matthew Longo, an American political scientist who teaches in the Netherlands, revisits in captivating detail the actions of ordinary people during that heady summer of 1989, when the Iron Curtain cracked and a magical word, freedom, swept across the Eastern Bloc. Within 2 years, the Soviet Empire was over. The story of 1989 is hardly terra incognita. A shelf full of books has documented the annus mirabilis in the words of the Polish Pope John Paul II. Timothy Garton Ash's The Magic Lantern, Victor Sebastian's Revolution 1989, and Michael Myers' The Year That Changed the World are among the standouts. But timing is everything. 3 decades hence, we are witnessing the return of history. Russia's territorial ambition is again on display in ways more consequential than anything since the beginning of the Cold War. Longo sets himself a tight focus, the Pan-European Picnic, a stunt of political theater organized by budding oppositionists, including the future Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, then a 26-year-old with wild black hair and fire in his eyes, and encouraged by a few reform-minded communist higher-ups, that turned into political action. The Picnic, a giant open-air party, convened on August 19, 1989, and attended by hundreds, surprised all by forcing open the barbed wire border between Austria and Hungary. Blending oral history and political theory, including cameos by Plato and Isaiah Berlin, Longo recounts the drama in a vivid, fast-paced narrative. A centerpiece is a revelatory sit-down. Miklos Nemeth, the Harvard-trained economist-turned-communist prime minister of Hungary who embraced radical change, entertains Longo at his retirement cottage amid the vineyards by Lake Balaton and opens a document trove. Yet throughout, Longo's argument rings clear. Sometimes the most important moments in history are forged by ordinary people. For Longo, the Picnic was a revolutionary moment, bringing not only euphoria, but an estimated 600 East Germans in Hungary on vacation across the border. The scene was utter chaos, Longo writes. East Germans celebrating on the other side of the line, Hungarian officers in heated conversations, Austrians walking into Hungary, Hungarians crossing into Austria. 3 months later, the Berlin Wall fell. And in August 1991, on the second anniversary of the Picnic, a crew of revanchist putschists failed miserably in Moscow, speeding the demise of the Soviet Union. Longo aims high, not only to revisit the field in Sopron-Puszta, now desolate and emptied of history, but to tell us how we got from tearing down the Berlin Wall to our new age of erecting barriers. It's an admirable goal, and he comes close to achieving it. Yet his cast is so large that one yearns for a key, and he oddly favors the paraphrase over a quote. The book abounds with references to interviews, archives, and private papers, but includes only a 3-page notes on sources at the end, no footnotes. Moreover, Longo's prose can slide from the opaque, the stickiness of lived time, to the trite. History is always a story of ghosts, figures of the past haunting the present, and the overwrought, an ancient sea as inscrutable as memory itself. But his narrative never lacks verve. Amid the rush of events, the analysis occasionally stumbles, recounting how Nemeth met Gorbachev during a visit by the Soviet apparatchik to Hungary in 1984. Longo describes their unexpected affinity. By the end of the trip, they were on a first-name basis, he writes, adding, Nemeth still uses the patronymic when he speaks of Gorbachev today. In fact, a patronymic connotes distance, not familiarity. Elsewhere, recalling a joke about communism that he used to think was funny, he writes, You pretend to work and we pretend to pay you. He goes on, It was a joke made by us for us. It cast a world we didn't know into terms we did. Actually, it was a Soviet joke, one dating at least to Brezhnev's rule. Such slips undermine Longo's contention that we were so deafened by our own ideology we couldn't hear the xenophobic vision behind the 1989 calls for national freedom. We don't talk anymore about freedom like we did in 1989, Longo writes. Freedom for collectivities, continents even, freedom for people fleeing oppression, wherever it is they were coming from. He is right, and yet he falls short on the how we got here part, dispensing with the transition to capitalism in a few sentences, terming it a period when many Hungarians felt as though they had just freed themselves from the shackle of one master, Moscow, only to fall into the arms of a new one, Brussels. Longo cannot fail to note Orbán's devolution into autocracy, including his anti-immigration policies. He called the wall he built on Hungary's border with Serbia Christian Europe's defensive line against the invading Muslim immigrants. Orbán started getting closer to Putin's Moscow, Longo writes. It was as though 1989 had never happened. But the Hungarians' ominous backward slide is given only cursory examination. All nations should have the opportunity for freedom, Gorbachev said in one of his final interviews. This may sound like wishful thinking, but it happened to be the foolhardy belief that animated the ordinary heroes of Longo's tale, both those who acted, politicians and civilians, and just as vitally, those who did not, border guards and party lifers, who owed all they had ever known to the status quo, as well as, not least, the peasant who rose to the Kremlin. This review was written by Andrew Meyer, a former Moscow correspondent for Time. He is the author most recently of Morgenthau, Power, Privilege, and the Rise of an American Dynasty. Cross Stitch by Jasmina Barrera. Needlework is often depicted as a peaceful activity, feminine, unthreatening, decorative. Yet in Jasmina Barrera's understated and lovely debut novel, Cross Stitch, translated from the Spanish by Christina McSweeney, embroidery is
Your regularly scheduled program is not available at this time. Please enjoy this special broadcast on AINC.
Thank you for joining us for the November 3rd, 2023 Friday reading of the New York Times travel section. My name is Michelle Wexler. Today, we'll be reading the following main articles in Tripped Up, Help, We're Booked on a Nile Cruise But Worry About Our Safety, written by Seth Kugel, and 36 Hours in Durham, North Carolina, written by Ingrid K. Williams, and following up with miscellaneous articles. We begin with the first article in Tripped Up, Help, We're Booked on a Nile Cruise But Worry About Our Safety. A Jewish couple about to go on a long-delayed $29,000 dream trip to Egypt and Jordan are afraid to travel because of the war in Gaza. But Viking says it's safe. This by Seth Kugel. Deer tripped up. After two pandemic-related delays, we were finally set to take a $34,309 Nile cruise with Viking, leaving October 25th and including several days in Cairo and additional excursions to Jerusalem and Petra in Jordan. But the war broke out, and the Middle East is very unstable. Viking canceled our excursion to Jerusalem, refunded that money, and rebooked our flights for October 29th. But we don't think Egypt or Jordan is particularly safe right now either, especially for Jews. We are older and are heartsick at not seeing Jerusalem, and terrified at the thought of being targeted as American Jewish tourists during this war. Viking still has $29,435 of our money. We only want a voucher to take the same trip in the future. Can you help? Joseph and Antonia, Oakland, California. Dear Joseph and Antonia, every traveler calculates risk in their own way, often through a mix of personal experience, news reports, and emotion. That's why it is unsurprising you are far from alone with your worries about traveling now. In recent weeks, plenty of consumers on online discussion boards have echoed your concerns. This is also a high-stakes issue for the travel industry, and it is hardly isolated to travel to countries surrounding Israel. Wildfires, earthquakes, and of course the pandemic have disrupted travel in the last few years, and often people fear traveling in proximity to natural disasters and human-created emergencies. But does the fact that you are afraid for your safety require a tour operator to refund you your money? I emailed Viking on your behalf on the morning of October 24th. 3 hours later, you received a $29,435 credit toward a future cruise, good as long as you book within 12 months. Was this a coincidence? I honestly don't know, since Viking responded to neither my initial email nor multiple other requests for comment. But the credit did represent an about-face from the company, whose replies to your earlier repeated inquiries via email had included mostly boilerplate language. Quote, "We completely understand your concern and we are sorry to hear of your disappointment," close quote, Viking wrote in one response. Quote, "You should know the safety of our guests and crew is our highest priority," close quote. They also told you they, quote, "work closely with our global network to understand the situation firsthand," close quote, and, quote, "are prepared to make any future adjustments as needed," close quote. To paraphrase, you're out of luck. You did make more progress by phone after receiving these rejections. On Saturday, October 21st, as you told me, a lead customer support specialist said she would check with management and get back to you by the following Monday. She did not, but eventually responded by saying she would try again. The next day, I wrote in. Whether it was her or me or both, the fact that Viking parried your initial requests should not be surprising. There is only mixed evidence that travel to Egypt or Jordan could be any more dangerous than when you made the booking. Yes, the State Department last month issued a worldwide caution notice that travelers should be alert to the potential for terrorist attacks, demonstrations, or violent actions against U.S. citizens and interests. But that's not specific to the Middle East, North Africa, or any destination. More relevantly, the U.S. Embassy in Cairo issued a demonstration alert warning that protests, potentially including anti-U.S. sentiment, may occur in Cairo or elsewhere in Egypt. But despite the possibility of demonstrations, the fact that Egypt borders Israel does not necessarily equate to danger throughout the country. Sudan, Egypt's southern neighbor, has been at war for 6 months, which has not seriously disrupted Egyptian tourism. And the State Department, which assigns danger levels from level 1, exercise normal precautions, to level 4, do not travel, has labeled Egypt a level 3, reconsider travel, in 2020, long before the Israel-Hamas war. Jordan, your other destination, remains at level 2, on a par with France and Peru. So though it may be obvious to you that travel to Egypt is too dangerous right now, it is not obvious to the State Department or to companies like Intrepid Travel. Matt Berna, Intrepid's president for the Americas, told me the company has neither canceled nor modified its Egypt and Jordan trips because of feedback from ground staff. "We have operations teams working with hotels," he said, "and group leaders out in the tourist sites and in the streets with the groups. They're feeling what's happening every day and reporting in to the country offices. A State Department Level 4 warning, though, would trump that," he said. Travelers like you are left in a difficult position when their risk assessment differs from the company they booked with. Even for those with travel insurance, geopolitical events are generally excluded from coverage. Only a cancel for any reason policy would cover such a disruption. The consumer is kind of faced with this awkward option of going on a trip and being really fearful, or not going on a trip and losing money, said Jeffrey Ment, a travel industry lawyer who has fielded probably 100 related inquiries from clients since the war began. But the companies he represents are also in a bind, he stressed, because, though we travelers rarely think about it, they have already spent some or even most of what you've paid them. "Follow the money," he said. "Maybe it's gone from a travel company to a cruise line, or from a cruise line to a fuel supplier, a food supplier, a staff supplier, or an entertainment supplier. And those other companies are not giving the money back because travel to Egypt is open and on. You can't force Viking or anybody else to just gratuitously refund the money that they don't have," he added. Well, you can't force them, but you can sometimes entreat them. Mr. Berna told me that Intrepid's internal policy does make room for this. "While we don't publicly announce free changes and free cancellations," he said, "if someone calls in and feels like they're just not going to have an enjoyable trip, a safe trip, then we're allowing them to change to a different date in the same region, or even a future credit." Or, as Mr. Ment told me when I asked him to assess Viking's decision to grant you credit, "it's common practice. The squeaky wheel wins." Luckily, there are many squeak aids available to travelers, even beyond writing to trippedup@nytimes.com. I welcome all travel-related complaints, though my capacity to squeak about Middle East refunds will likely not go beyond this column. There's posting online reviews and registering more formal complaints through the Better Business Bureau and Elliott Advocacy, both nonprofits. The offices of your state's attorney general are used to taking on travel companies, though state laws vary, and you can ask your credit card to squeak for you through a chargeback request, as long as you are ready to go back and forth with them for months. Still, everyone should start with a personal squeak. Call or write to the companies yourself, attempting, with patience and politeness, to get bumped up the customer service ranks until you reach someone who has the power to make an exception. That story in Tripped Up, entitled "Help, We're Booked on a Nile Cruise, But Worry About Our Safety." That story by Seth Kugel. If you need advice about a best-laid travel plan that went awry, send an email to trippedup@nytimes.com. And next up in 36 hours, 36 hours, Durham, North Carolina. This by Ingrid K. Williams. Ingrid K. Williams is a regular contributor to the travel section and a former Durham resident who has reported on North Carolina since 2010. The evolution of Durham from a faded tobacco town to a diverse cultural and culinary destination has been years in the making. but the ongoing development of this central North Carolina city seems to have reached a new stage. The resurgent downtown area, long a transitional neighborhood with pockets of progress, is now brimming with new restaurants, boutiques, bars, and breweries. And while construction continues apace amid the historic brick warehouses, tobacco factories, and textile mills, for good and ill, visitors today have reason to venture farther afield, to emerging hotspots in East Durham and the Old Five Points neighborhood. This season, only the brilliant fall foliage can compete with all the terrific food, drink, and local color there is to discover across Durham, as residents affectionately call the dynamic Bull City. Itinerary, Friday, 3:30 p.m., visit a campus museum. Anyone concerned that artificial intelligence will eventually do their job may be put at ease by the new exhibition at Duke University's Nasher Museum of Art. Act as if you are a curator, which was organized not by museum staff, but by ChatGPT, OpenAI's popular chatbot, through January 14th, free admission. The eclectic AI-generated exhibition spans Mesoamerican stone figures and Salvador Dali works selected from the museum's nearly 14,000-piece collection, though many were mislabeled by the chatbot, as noted by a flesh-and-blood curator. More cohesive is the moving and human-curated exhibition of photographs and collage installations from the artist Lyle Ashton Harris through January 7th. While on campus, stroll through the nearby Sarah P. Duke Gardens, where 5 miles of serene pathways wind past magnolias, blooming roses, and a lake reflecting autumnal colors. 6 p.m., feast on Carolina seafood. Fresh seasonal seafood caught off the North Carolina coast is the simple winning formula at Saltbox Seafood Joint, a restaurant owned by the chef Ricky Moore, who earned the 2022 James Beard Award for the best chef in the Southeast. What began as a tiny takeaway shack in the Old Five Points neighborhood is now a spacious but still frill-free sit-down locale on Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard. Luckily, the menu hasn't changed much. You can still get heaping plates of fried oysters, blue crab, mullet, and clams with generous portions of fried potatoes and collard greens. My go-to is the fried catfish sandwich topped with citrusy red cabbage slaw, $14, and a side of hush honeys, the chef's trademarked take on cornmeal fritters drizzled with honey, $4. 8:30 p.m., try a local beer by the fire pit. The competition is growing among the many craft breweries downtown, where out-of-town brewers like Asheville's Dissolver and Highwire Brewing have opened Durham tap rooms in an area that's already home to longtime local favorites like Full Steam Brewery and the Dirty Bull Brewing Company. But on a crisp fall evening, the most atmospheric place for a locally brewed pint is easily Pony Saurus Brewing Company, an independent craft brewery with crackling fire pits and a leafy garden strung with lights. Try the tangerine-tinged Golden Rule Saison, $6, and a scoop of the house snack mixes, like the pretzel and peanutty Bartender's Blend, $1. Saturday, 9:30 a.m., take a history lesson. Swing by Monuts, a 9th-century bakery and cafe, to pick up a cinnamon and molasses glazed pumpkin spice donut, $2.50, and a hot apple chider, a steaming blend of apple cider and chai tea, $5.50, before heading out west for a drive into North Carolina history. Beyond Civil War scholars, few are likely to recall what transpired at Bennett Place, a historic farmstead about 6 miles northwest of downtown. One of the few Civil War sites not associated with battle, this out-of-the-way landmark is where the Union General, William T. Sherman, and the Confederate General, Joseph E. Johnston, negotiated the largest troop surrender of the war. Nearly 90,000 soldiers from the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida, inside the home of a local family in 1865. Begin a visit in the small museum, where a short video explains the site's significance, then head across the lawn to tour the reconstructed farmhouse and surrounding outbuildings where the generals hashed out the terms. Free admission. 12 p.m., Sikh sandwiches in the East. A former food desert, East Durham has emerged as a lunchtime destination for hungry diners from across the city. You'll know you've found Ideals, a sandwich shop that opened in 2021, by the line snaking down the sidewalk. Don't worry, it moves quickly. Here, freshly baked rolls, sesame-crusted hoagies, and rosemary focaccia are the foundation for superb deli sandwiches. Best is the Philly-style roast pork with provolone and garlicky broccoli rabe, $8.50 for a half hoagie, and the thick-cut garlic and onion potato chips, $1.75. Another notable newcomer is Mike D's Barbecue, a barbecue joint that opened nearby in July. Go there for a brisket sandwich doused with the signature smoky sweet sauce, $10, a side of smoked beans, $5, and sweet tea, $4. 2 p.m., sip North Carolina bourbon. Whatever your preferred spirit, there's likely someone in Durham distilling it. Small production craft booze from mead and cider to gin and rye have exploded in popularity recently, and one producer worth seeking out is Mystic Farm and Distillery, about 6 miles east of downtown. Drop in at this bucolic 22-acre bourbon distillery for a free tasting of the full range of spirits, including the award-winning Broken Oak Bourbon, and a smooth cacao-finished version made with cacao nibs from Raleigh's Vittery Chocolate Factory. Small group tours are also offered on weekends, $20 reserve in advance. 4 p.m., flip-through records and secondhand finds. Supporting local businesses is a point of pride in this fiercely loyal city, as evidenced by the growing number of small independent shops downtown. Start on West Parish Street at the Durham Vintage Collective, an inviting secondhand boutique that opened in July, where you might find plaid miniskirts, leather jackets, or a framed Jean-Michel Basquiat lithograph. Across the street, explore Chet Miller, a well-stocked gift shop with Durham-themed throw pillows, small press travel guides, cookbooks from local chefs, and game night jigsaw puzzles. Right next door, Utopia Design opened last year, selling exquisite Polish glassware and handcrafted ceramics. Scope out the latest color-splashed exhibition at Ella West Gallery, a sunny space that opened in August, showcasing contemporary art from Black, female, and other diverse and underrepresented artists. Then continue to East Main Street to browse vinyl albums of jazz, soul, rock, and bluegrass at Carolina Soul Records and at the new location of Bull City Records across the street. 7 p.m., dine on fresh Mexican-American flavors. Downtown Durham is packed with great restaurants, but head a bit north to the old Five Points neighborhood, where the city's latest hotspot, Little Bull, opened on a quiet block in June. The chef, Oscar Diaz, already well-known in Raleigh for his Mexican-American cuisine, again tapped his heritage when creating the playful menu. Highlights of a recent meal included crudo with North Carolina tuna, aguachile, wasabi, and flying fish roe, $18, plantain empanadas, $16, and soft dumplings stuffed with goat birria,